I am overwhelmed by the size of the crowd, and I know that you're all here because of the topic that the Dead Sea Scrolls. But before I start, I have some preliminary remarks. Since they gave the wonderful organizer and a creator of this project, Ari Katz, 3 hours, and me 3 minutes, I remember a tale when there was a speaker that got up and started speaking and speaking for an audience like this, and one after another, they started walking out. There's only one person left, and he had been given 20 minutes to speak, and he went on endlessly. So the person, when he finally finished, he went up to him and he said, you know, you were asked to speak for 20 minutes. He says, yes, I don't have a watch. He says, I know, but there's a calendar. So for the 3 minutes or for the 3 hours, first of all, I would like to dedicate this lecture this evening to my mother, a blessed memory, for whom I'm observing Yahrzeit this evening, and to tell you that there is probably no more exciting discovery. It is the prime discovery of the last century, the Dead Sea Scrolls, about which we could engage, I'm here for a month, for a whole month's seminar. And there has been so much about the Dead Sea Scrolls that has made the sensational press that, of course, is just for secular sensationalism, but has nothing to do with the truth. The true series you may have seen on Nova, on Discovery, on BBC, but on the others, you have to take it with more than a grain of salt, because there were headlines saying that according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, the next great flood, which will destroy the humanity, will take place in 1998. There was a headline in one of these magazines that said, Elvis Presley has been discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that's serious. In addition, another headline said, literally, I'm quoting, better dead than read, because it takes away from the uniqueness of Jesus, and it proves that Jesus was never crucified on the cross. I can go on and on with all this hype. It's sensational. And tonight, you're going to hear why it is. You're a lucky people. The Dead Sea Scrolls, I think what I'd like to do is to divide my presentation into three parts. One, the significance of the scrolls for the study of Bible, which is my primary interest. Second, for the understanding of early Judaism. And last but not least, for an understanding of early Christianity. Well, let's start at the very beginning before we get into those three major subjects. A little review of how it all began. In 1947, there was a shepherd boy who was tending his herd when a goat went off and entered a cave. Now, everyone knows who's subject to superstition that caves are the abodes of genie. So he did not go into the cave, but he took a nice-sized rock, threw it into the cave in order to frighten the goat out. Well, instead of hearing the reverberation of the rock against the cave wall, he heard something smash, which of course even made him more frightened. But he went in and he put his hand into an amphora, which is a large vase, and he felt scrolls in his hands. There were 7 scrolls in that cave, and because that was the first cave to be discovered, we call it Cave 1, and as the judge so correctly mentioned, when you go down to the Dead Sea, this is 15 kilometers south of Jericho. You pass Masada, or right before Masada, you will come to the Qumran Caves. This fella, of course, this young shepherd, was an illiterate boor. He could not read nor write, and he took it to a dealer in Bethlehem. There were seven scrolls there, all written on parchment, which is animal hide, and that's important for a moment. I'll elaborate. And the question was, were these authentic or not authentic? Because they had never seen anything like this before. Well, the antique dealer in Bethlehem immediately sold four of them, four of the seven, for $100. $100. But he still wanted to know, to authenticate, to verify, to validate the authenticity. And there was only one man in Israel at that time, in 1947, who could do it, and that was the head of archaeology at the Hebrew University. His name was Professor Sukenik, whose son, most of you have probably heard, his son was Yigael Yadin. Sukenik, and this would make a veritable cinema drama. You remember that in 47, the city was still divided. Sukenik stealthily made his way to Bethlehem, verified the last three, that they were legit, made it back across the Mandelbaum Gate, which was the division between East and West Jerusalem, just as the first shots rang out to begin the War of Independence. It's a remarkable tale. He got back safely. But no one ever knew what happened to those three scrolls until 1954. And you can check this because so many of you are internet fans. In 1954, June the 1st, page 14 of the Wall Street Journal, there was a 1.5-inch ad which said, three scrolls for sale. And Yadin realized that these must be the three that just disappeared from the horizon. So he went to New York and he purchased the three for $250,000. The first four were $100, $250,000. And since I will probably not get to it because I have so much to tell you about the scrolls, I just want you to know that there is a private dealer today. I can't tell you anything more than that because it's top secret classified, who has a fragment exactly this large, $1 million. You see how it skyrocketed? Because of the unbelievable importance. And why important? Because of what I have to share with you. Now, once these first scrolls were discovered, there was a mad rush, and they realized the wealth and the worth of these scrolls. There was a mad race between shepherd Bedouins and archaeologists. And in every instant, the Bedouin won out. And how do we know? Because every cave we entered, we found a pack of Marlboro, an empty pack. They beat us each time and every time. Well, my friends, altogether, there were 11 caves that were discovered that contained scrolls. Now, there are many, many more caves that were excavated, and we have important findings. But for scrolls alone, we have 11 caves, and they were discovered from 1947 to 1956. Every summer, we engage in a salvage excavation, hoping to find some more, but we have not. We're still continuing. These scrolls then had to be dated. We're talking about scrolls. I want you to know that 90% of them are written in Hebrew, 7% are written in Aramaic. It's about 61 documents, and 3% are written in Greek. Altogether, we had literally tens of thousands of fragments. And the only reason, there's so many people who have followed me, the only reason that today you see a very novel tie that I'm wearing is because I am wearing literally a Dead Sea Scroll tie. This is an honor of you and the lecture. And if you want to see it, come close. This, you will see that the scrolls, when I say, I don't know how many of you can see it from afar, but instead of bringing you pictures, I brought a tie. And you will see that some of the fragments are only of the length of 1 millimeter. And some would go the entire length, I would say the entire length of this temple and more so. And that is the Isaiah scroll that the judge mentioned that you've seen when you went to the shrine of the book. Tens of thousands of fragments, from snippets to entire books. And of these tens of thousands, 9, we understand, we can assume that they consisted of some 900 books. Now you have to understand, we don't have 900 books there. But if we have one sentence or one verse from a book that we know, that means that entire book was there, but we haven't found it yet. So we may have 4 verses from the book of Chronicles, but that means then Chronicles was there, and so on and so forth. So we can reconstruct some 900 volumes from tens of thousands of fragments, 1/4 of which, between 200 and 250, deal with the Bible, our biblical text. How do we date them? There are many ways whereby you date a fragment, and these discoveries, I'll share with you 2. One is of polygraphy. Polygraphy means you study the way in which the scrolls are written. You see, if you're digging in your backyard tomorrow and you find a manuscript and it's written in the Gothic script, you know it wasn't written last year, because they stopped writing English in the Gothic script a long time ago. So we now can trace the history of the English script as well as the history of the Hebrew script. And they wrote Hebrew in different styles at different times. The result of paleography showed us that the scrolls more or less go back to 150 before the Common Era till 68 of the Common Era. And why can we be so exact? Because when the Romans came down and destroyed the Second Temple in 70 of the Common Era, they went through Qumran and they destroyed Qumran on their way to Yerushalayim. So in 68 is the cutoff date, 150 about is the primary date, the earlier date. But this was also subjected to carbon-14 tests. I told you that the majority of the documents are written on parchment. Parchment is hide, it's animal hide, it gives its organic matter, and you can test it by this way of a carbon-14. And then we use something very, very highly sophisticated we got from NASA, and that is AMS, it's accelerated mass spectrometry, which also, for a little bit of a milligram of a millimeter of a piece of a scroll, we can date it. The dates for both paleographical and carbon-14 show us that this is the parameter, some 200 years existence, so 150 to 68. Now, these scrolls are very, very significant, as I mentioned to you, in my eyes, for 3 important reasons. That's the Bible, Judaism, and Christianity. Let's start out with the Bible. When you come to your synagogue, when you come to your temple, and you're listening to the Torah reading, you're opening up your Torah book, your Chumash, you are holding in your hand Gutenberg from the 15th, 16th century. Anybody who's in the world of scholarship wants to know the original. You want to see manuscripts. I don't care if you're studying Shakespeare or Byron, if you're studying Kafka or any genius. You want to see the original manuscript, because after this manuscript gets copied and copied and copied and finally printed and published, is that the way he originally wrote? Well, you'll be amazed to hear that the earliest complete biblical manuscript we have is dated to 925 of our Common Era, about 1,000 years ago. We have nothing earlier. And then you say, wait a second, if I just take a David and Solomon who lived at 1,000 before the Common Era, if I take an Isaiah who lived around 725 before the Common Era, we're talking about some 2,000 years. We're talking about, if it's Isaiah, 700 before to 925 after, we're talking about manuscripts that were written 1,600 years later. Is that what he really said? You know, anytime you copy something, you always may make a mistake. All of a sudden, we have Hebrew manuscripts of the Bible in our hands 1,000 years earlier than the earliest biblical manuscript. Are you still with me? 1,000 years earlier than the earliest biblical manuscript heretofore. Now, we're still some 700 years away from Isaiah, but we're 1,000 years closer. And then the question was, new, so is it or isn't it? And here is where we had one of the most remarkable discoveries of all, and we have to do this very slowly. We found, I told you, over 200 biblical manuscripts of every book of the Bible. Again, it may be a couple verses or it can be an entire Isaiah scroll. Every book of the Bible except the book of Esther. And if you want to know why Esther wasn't there, come Thursday night to the JCC. This has been very shrewdly arranged. Why didn't Esther make those caves? But every other book is there. And there was a field day because we now have original Hebrew manuscripts. Now we have to take a little excursus. And I want to teach you two new things. The Hebrew Bible was translated for the first time by Jews about 250 before the Common Era. It was translated into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. The reason for it was the Jews of Alexandria no longer read Hebrew. And therefore, there was a request, please translate the Bible into Greek so that we can read it. And when the translation was done, and we have the translation today, and when we study the Greek translation, we see that there are times when the Greek Jewish translator is translating something other than what we have in our text. I have the Hebrew text in front of me in Shul. I have the Greek translation of a Hebrew text, which is different from this. So we said, that's probably because the translator didn't do a great job, or the translator's copyist erred, and therefore these mistakes were internal Greek mistakes. Number two, there was a group that branched off from the Jews very early, and that group was called the Samaritans. You may only know of them from the Good Samaritan of the New Testament. The Samaritans were Jews that branched off. And by the way, they're still alive. Very small number. They live in Israel. The Samaritans, before they branched off, they had the Chumash. They had the Torah in the original Hebrew. And when we look at their original Hebrew text, we see that there are also differences from their text as from our text. So we said, well, that's because they made mistakes. Now, the most amazing discovery was that in them there caves at Qumran, we discovered those very Hebrew manuscripts that were behind the Greek translation, and that were those from which the Samaritans translated. In other words, my friends, and this is going to be shocking, I know, that in Qumran, we have different Hebrew biblical text. Now you say, how can that be? And I want to explain it to you because I know this all comes as a tremendous revolution in thought. You see, at the time when these were being written, and they were being written by many, many groups, there was not yet a single authoritative, absolute text. The text gets selected by the rabbis hundreds of years later. But before the rabbis selected this text, they also had this Hebrew one and this Hebrew one. They opted for this one. But that one at times is better or not better than the others. What does that mean? And this is the bottom line. The biblical books were set, were canonized, were holy. But the text of the book could still vary. Now, when I say vary, I don't mean in a way that in one text it's going to say, and God said to Moses, another text it's going to say, and God said to someone else. Some are minor differences, but there are also major differences. But the people at Qumran could live with three different and more variant texts. We can't today. You cannot say, I want you to turn to verse so-and-so, and in your text, it's another verse. You cannot have a religion that does not have one authoritative, absolute text. And the rabbi selected that text. And when they selected that Hebrew text instead of these Hebrew texts, these were pushed out of existence. And we were totally unaware of the other Hebrew manuscripts of our very same Hebrew Bible until the time of the discovery of Qumran. And today, of course, we can have any other. We call this the Masoretic text. There is only one. But now we realize there were many more than one. So you understand that for the study of the Bible, for the development of the Bible, for the canonization of the Bible, this is so, so important. And for readings that are different than the ones we have. Can you imagine? There are different readings. But maybe we'll go on to that later on. I want to go into the second section, and that is its significance for early Judaism. At this Second Temple times, we know from our earliest historian, whose name is Josephus, and our earliest Jewish philosopher, whose name is Philo, that there were three religious sects in Israel. One was called the Pharisees. And by the way, I want you to know, we are the progeny of the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees ultimately became the rabbis of the Talmud, which ultimately us. Another group, the oligarchical priestly group, was called the Sadducees. And the third group was called the Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S. They numbered, according to these writers, about 4,000. When these scrolls were discovered, and scholars reread these early writings of the historian and the philosopher who said, there is a settlement of Essenes near Jericho, next to the Dead Sea. They said, here it is. We have found the Essene settlement. And today, most scholars believe that these are the Essenes. Why is that important? Because I told you that we have some 900 text volumes, one quarter of which is the Bible, but what about the rest? And here was our next great discovery. We found the literature of the Jewish Essenes. We didn't have it before, my friends. All we have at that time, we have a Mishnah, we have a Talmud, that's a product of Pharisaic Judaism. Can you imagine, and I want this to bear upon you with all of its gravity, that you walk into a library, which this was, and you discover a repository, you discover a collection of volumes that are not listed in the Library of Congress, that has every book ever published in the world and every manuscript. We walked into a totally new library. It was the writings of this group, the Essenes, who disappeared from history, just as the Sadducees disappeared because the Pharisees won out. And now we have a totally new literature, Jewish, authentic, that we never knew existed. And it tells us about this group. And very briefly, I will describe, maybe you'll go into it in other detail, in the question and answer. This was the first kibbutz in human history. They were a communal settlement, a settlement of ultra-religious Jews. What happened? The high priesthood was always in Jerusalem in the hands of one mishpacha, one family. It was called the Tzaddikite family. But when the Maccabees, you all know the Maccabees in Hanukkah, but you never get to read the next year after Hanukkah, which means after the rededication of the temple, after the celebration of Hanukkah, the Maccabee and the Hasmonean brothers took over the high priesthood in Israel. This was the first time since the beginning of the time of David and Solomon. And that's 1,000 years later, and he who took it over was not a member of that family. And therefore, these Jews said, this is a wicked priesthood. These are usurpers. We can't live in Yerushalayim, in the temple, with such a priest at top, the high priest. So they left. And they went over the mountains until they found this secluded spot, encampment by the Dead Sea, and there they made it their homes in these caves where the parchment fragments were found and in the settlement nearby. Therefore, they outdid the Jerusalem priesthood, and their laws of purity, their laws of halacha were much more stringent than even those found in the Talmud, because they believed that they were the elect. They believed that God selected them. And they have a wonderful scroll called the War of the Sons of Light against the War of the Sons against the Sons of Darkness. We never knew of it. I just must tell you, you and I are all the sons of darkness. They were the sons of light. And there's going to be a war at the end of days when we will be decimated, and only the sons of light, who are they, will prevail, because they are a holy encampment. And they were very stringent and pedantic and punctilious about their laws of sacredness. When they would get up early in the morning, they would do their ablutions. They would eat and do their ablutions. They would go to work for most of the day and do their ablutions. They would come back and do their ablutions and eat, and then they would spend one-third of every night in study. If you wanted to get into this group, you had to first dedicate all of your wealth, all of your property to the commune, and then you were given a 2-year initiatory test. If you passed the test, and my friends, the test was very difficult. One example, if you were found spitting, you got a 30-day penalty. These laws of joining the fraternity were very, very harsh and severe. But if after you did pass the test of 2 years, then you have your ritual bathing, and you can join them for the communal meal finally. So these Essenes were a group heretofore unknown, literature unread, and we discovered them. Meaning, we now discovered the breadth of Judaism at that time that we never knew, because our eyes were always centered and concentrated on the one group who ultimately we are. And now we learn about our brothers. By the way, how many were there in Qumran of these Essenes? You won't believe it. Maximally 300. Minimally 150. How do you know? Well, there are ways whereby we know. When we went into the dining room, we measured it. Then we measured the amount of water, the cubic feet of water that could be amassed in the wells from which they would drink, and then we excavated their cemetery. So altogether, we're talking about some 300, a couple of hundred, who caused the greatest revolution in the history of Judaism and Christianity, and that's it. And by the way, today's scholars, when they write books, from the last 10 years, no longer call their book The History of Judaism. Get this carefully. They say The History of Judaisms. There were different Judaisms. And this group believed in predeterminism. You know that we don't believe that, that everything is predetermined. We have free will. They believed it was predetermined. These people believed, and I told you, an eschatological, that means the end of days, a war between them and everyone else in which they will win. They believed in such severity that they were the elect holy camp, that they actually have their songs which they would chant together with the angels. We found a tremendous amount of literature there. Not only how do you get into their group, but what they were writing, if it were prayers, hymns, mystical text, wisdom text, and almost every genre you can think, psalms as well. Just as a footnote, I'll tell you, if you open up the book of Psalms, you're going to find there are 150. So why aren't there 151? There are, because they had the 151st. David stopped writing after 150. We have the 151st Psalm, which was preserved in the Septuagint, the Greek translation from a Hebrew original. They had it. A psalm that was lost has been rediscovered. So you can imagine the tremendous impact and import. Well, as I said, they believed in predeterminism. They believed that they were the sons of light and you and I the sons of darkness. And we can go on and on, but I want to leave a little time for Christianity. So the bottom line of Judaism, the vast panoramic picture of a Jewish group, a very religious Jewish group, who was separated, seceded from Jerusalem. One other point I want to bring out to you, and that is that this group had, and this will be shocking, I know, they had a different calendar. You know, we Jews live by a lunar calendar. We have the blessing of the new month. We live by a lunar calendar. They had a solar calendar. And if you have a calendar that goes only by the sun and not by the moon, you realize the calendars are not going to coordinate with one another. So what happens? Can you imagine? You're in Jerusalem. You want to invite your friend over for Pesach. And he says, but I'm celebrating Sukkot. You can't have two different Hebrew texts of the Bible. You can't have two different calendars. They believe that the original calendar in the Bible was solar and not lunar, and they live by that. But they were just as authentic as we were. We, meaning rabbinic Judaism, meaning Pharisaic Judaism, that ultimately beat the Essene Judaism. Part three, Christianity. We always knew that early Christianity was a combination of two inputs. One was Judaism, and one was a great impact of the Roman polytheistic cults. The problem was, we could not find in our text from where that input came. And why couldn't we? because our texts are the Pharisaic rabbinic Talmudic texts. Now, when we found the Essene text, we find the cradle, the embryo, the seed from whence Christianity will ultimately arise. Because these Essenes, in their practices and in their writings, have many avenues of that parallel the earliest Christian text. Now, I want you to know that no text of the New Testament was found there, and that is for the following reason. The first book of the New Testament was written only in 70 of the Common Era, decades after Jesus passed away. And I told you that Qumran was destroyed in 68 of the Common Era. So the first book of the New Testament was only written after Qumran was destroyed. Therefore, there are no texts of the New Testament there. But, my friends, there are so many likenesses. Let's just share a few. First, what I already emphasized, this over-possessiveness of ablutions and ritual bathings. And the fact that once you are finally admitted into the group, you have to take a ritual bath that ultimately is going to become the rite of baptism. And we know that the forerunner of Jesus, John the Baptist, spent many years around the Dead Sea. And if he wasn't a member of this group, he at least was very, very acquainted with the habits, the habitat, and the beliefs of this group. And John the Baptist was the one who very much emphasized these ritual bathings at all time during the day. We have, in early Christianity, the belief that they are the chosen people. That's exactly what the Essenes said. They believed at times in predeterminism. That's what the Essenes. We even have in one or two of the books of the New Testament the expression that appears no other place, sons of light, directly from this scroll, sons of light versus the sons of darkness. We don't have sons of darkness. They have sons of light. You know, blessed is the man that, what is called in the New Testament, the Beatitudes. We have Beatitudes. Happy is the person. Blessed is the person. We have Beatitudes in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the Essenes believe that they were living 1 minute before midnight, that the world was about to come to an end with this victorious battle. Early Christianity said the very same thing. They believed that they were living 1 minute before the end of the world. The anticipatory ending was just around the corner. So what does that mean? Does this take away from the uniqueness of Jesus? There was a book that was written some 10 years ago in America that said that the main thesis of the book is that the Vatican is directly suppressing the publications of the scrolls because it will do away with the uniqueness of Jesus. Now, how did this come into being altogether? You see, my friends, if we can backtrack, and towards this, I will take a breather if you have questions. If we backtrack a bit, I told you we found 7 scrolls, and then we have 10,000 of fragments, which consist of 900 volumes, 250 or 200 are biblical ones, and then their entire literature and other books, which I haven't discussed so far. All of these were placed in the hands of 7 great scholars, 7 Christian scholars who huddled together in East Jerusalem. And the scrolls weren't coming out. Why? First of all, look at this and try to put these fragments together. You see, if you have a book of Genesis, then you know "Let there be light" is right here. And it won't be, and God said to Abraham. So you put this here and you put that there. But what happens when you find a book that never existed before? You have to be an unbelievable jigsaw puzzler to decipher it. So because of the unbelievable task, that's number one. Number two, they were all professors, so they all had their graduate students and they had classes. Number three, not everyone, like the present lecturer, works 24 hours a day. And therefore, things weren't coming out. But when things are not coming out, rumors start to spread. Why aren't they coming out? They're deliberately not publishing them, which, of course, was total nonsense. But it remained that way, and it was very sluggish until 1967, when we had the reunification of Jerusalem. We went into the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem where these were housed, and immediately we expanded the group from seven. We left the seven because they were great. We expanded the seven to 22 and from 22 to 55, and it ultimately got up to 97. Men, women, Jews, Protestants, and Catholics, and then the volume started coming out one after another. By the way, you've never seen these volumes. If you go to Borders or Barnes and Nobles, you will see a shelf full of material on the Dead Sea Scroll. But though that shelf full of books is written based on the volumes we put out, which are not in the bookshops. They're put out, they're called DJD, Discoveries in the Judean Desert. They're put out by Oxford University Press in England. And each volume cost us $100,000 to produce. We have now produced 40 of them. We have two or three more to go. These are voluminous volumes which contain the photographs, the translations, the transliterations, the transcriptions, and commentary with all different fonts. It is a magnum opus in the world of publishing. From these, we get the books that you see and you read about. Well, we're almost finished. And when everything gets finished, then there will be a revamping of ideas and everything can be rethought through together. But I mention this to you because there was no suppression of so that the uniqueness of Jesus would be taken away. The uniqueness of Jesus stands. What we see is that which will become early Christianity was originally a good Jewish sect. It was one of the many sects which were prevalent in Palestine in those days. And from one of those, which was very like the one of the Essenes, ultimately is going to spring Christianity. But when it does spring, it is taking with it some original Jewish ideas that now we know from whence they came. So, my friends, you can see how much there is, how the excitement is still very, very, I would say, ongoing, and how it is of importance for Bible scholars, for students of religion, for students of Judaism, for students of Christianity. And there's no end to it, and neither to the surprise. Because I must end with this, as I started with my tie, I will end with another tie-in. 2 hours before I got to this temple this evening, I put on my email, and I found that a very, very lovely and loyal student of mine sent me something, a lecture on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I said, great, now I have my material for this evening. And I read to the very end. It was on internet, never saw it before. And the last thing says, this was written by, which are notes that were taken when I heard Professor Paul's lecture.
This is being taped, so I have to stick to this mic. All I said, there was nothing dead about Professor Shalom Paul's lecture. Now, the question and answer session. Ernie, back there, I think we've got, how much? We got about a half hour, roughly. I don't have a watch, so I'll watch you on the thing. And I'm going to use a little trial and error on this. We're going to start out with written questions only, and then see how we go on the time. And if there's time left, we'll go to oral, verbal questions. Slava Gaze and Anita Singer. Where's Anita? Over there. And who's the gentleman that's helping you? Your name, sir? Okay, Fred. Are going to start passing out pieces of paper. Those of you that want to ask questions and write them out, raise your hand right now, please, okay? And put only one question on a piece of paper. Please don't put two questions on. Raise your hands. So we're going to get this going immediately. We have about a half hour. We have about a half hour. Raise your hands, please. Raise your hands, please. I'm doing this because it's not something arbitrary. I've done it before when during my 10-year stint of the University of California Irvine Lecture Series in Clubhouse 3, and some people are a little shy about standing up. They didn't take the Dale Carnegie course, you see. So we'll do that first, and I assure you, those of you that want to stand up and talk, we'll work you in. Now, get your hands up. I want to tell you that Professor Shalom Paul wears, should I say, many hats or many yarmulkes or many kippahs. There's this literature on the table out there in the foyer entitled Kenya Through Jewish Eyes, August 18 to 29, 2003. Whoever printed this forgot to put the CE after the 2003. 2003 in the Common Era. Fully escorted, deluxe kosher safari with Professor Shalom Paul visiting Nairobi, the Serengeti, Lake Elementia, Sweetwater, Samburu, and the Mount Kenya Safari Club. That sounds like pretty good competition to Wild Animal Park down in San Diego here. So if you want to know more about this, pick them up, and I'm sure that they'll be able to talk to you later. Okay, I've got a bunch of questions here, and I'm going to stand over here and hand them to you. Mine is the first question, but I'm going to let you read them yourself, okay? But I'll read mine. In Rabbi Telushkin's book, he has a one-volume encyclopedia. He makes the distinction between the Essenes and a separate Dead Sea sect as the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why does he make the distinction, and would you explain that, please? Here.
Just one note to correct a pronunciation. The last words were a safari that the judge was reading. There's a safari that I take trips around the world with Jewish groups. Some of you are already signed up for it. If you'd like to read, the brochures are out there. If you're interested, there'll be a phone number where you can call. And these are trips which are very, very unique. And as I say, they go around the world. The next one will be to Kenya in the middle of August. Joseph Telushkin says it is another group other than the Essenes, I think will probably be explained in Telushkin's book. In other words, I do not know why Telushkin said why another group wrote them. If I knew what his arguments were, I would be able to deal with the judge. But you realize I cannot foresee something that you're not bringing to the court, except to say that I can surmise, even though I don't have Telushkin's book. I told you that the majority of scholars think still that the group that wrote these texts and the group that were in Qumran were the Essenes. There are some, and maybe Telushkin as well, but Telushkin does not deal with this period. There are some who say, no, these were not the Essenes, but these were the third group, the Sadducees. Why they say that is for the following reason. Now, again, this may not be in Telushkin's book at all, so you're getting an extra bonus. Read his, and then you'll hear mine. We have found a letter that may have been written by the founder of the sect, who was called Mure HaTzedek, the teacher of righteousness. And in this letter, he details the difference in halacha between us and you. The us are the group at Qumran. The you are the people in Jerusalem. And when we studied who are the you, we know who are the us. This is bad grammar, but you understand. We know who the us are. But who are the you? And when we study Talmudic law, the you appears to be the Pharisees, which was understandable. But the us, according to the law, seems to reflect the halachic differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I know this is highly, 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 highly difficult. I can give you examples, but it will really be, I think, too pedantic. In other words, this letter is written by us to you. The you we know now are the Pharisees. Who writes it? The us may be, according to the letter, the Sadducees. So it may be that Telushkin says it wasn't the Essenes because of this letter. If he doesn't say because of that, then you'll have to find out from him himself. Can you comment on the concept of dual messiahs in the Damascus document and its relationship to Melchizedek and to the history of Jewish thought? Where is Thea?
Let me say this. The weather was very bad outside, and the freeway system here is a little hazardous. I had Thea Eber all ready to be the lecturer tonight in case you didn't make it. Thea, stand up. Come on.
Thea, you probably teach the Dead Sea Scrolls, I would assume. Oh, I see. I am very impressed. Very impressed. In particular, by your T-shirt. Yes, the last time I met a woman wearing a Greek T-shirt, I mean, it was love at first Greek. Do you know what's written there?
Yes.
Exactly. Wow, that's very, very impressive. Huh? Well, it's parts of the text are covered over, and out of modesty, it's best not to read it all. I will deal with this.
Explain that.
Oh, yes, and I shall. Fine. Thea, I will do this very quickly because this we would have to obviously converse together. Let me just give a somewhat of a surface answer that will answer you, but also this is entirely new, the thought behind it, the knowledge behind it. So very, very briefly. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have in this group, still probably the Essenes, if you want, Sadducees, this group believed in two messiahs. A messiah that is from the house of Aaron, that would be the priestly messiah, and a messiah that will come from the house of David, which will be the royal kingly messiah. Both of these will come and be present at this eschatological end of time war, will lead the battle, and what happens is that the Qumran, again, I'll have to be a bit technical, the Qumran end of days was not the concept of the Christian end of days. It wasn't the end of history, but it was more restorative. In other words, we will go back with the Messiah, meaning a leader from the house of David, and the leader from the house of the priestly group, and that is from the house of Aaron, and we will have the golden age and live happily forevermore. This concept of Messiah is not the Christian concept of Messiah. The Christian concept of Messiah, which develops as you, I mean, we don't even have to go into it, also believes in a Messiah, but in a resurrected Messiah and of a reborn community afterwards. And this, of course, is entirely different from the concept of the two Messiahs in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You also said, and talk a little bit about Melchizedek. Melchizedek is a personality who is mentioned twice in the Hebrew Bible. And he's mentioned twice as an individual, a human being. This group turned that personality into an angelic personality, even called him by the name of Elohim, God, gave him a form of divinization up in heaven, and this he became in this literature what we would call an archangel. So Thea, if you can, I will suffice with that. But this was some question there. Next time we're only going to take our own question. I read in a book about the Dead Sea Scrolls that they found a portion of the Gospel of Luke which heralded the birth of Jesus. Please comment. Okay. Again, where is the questionnaire? Because it's not signed. Not that it matters, but if you want to keep your modesty and humility. Who asked the question? I would. Okay, no one. Wow. I mean, this was really a supernatural lecture. They're starting to rain down upon us. The answer is no. The answer is no. There was, in a certain cave, Cave 7, where they found some Greek fragments. By the way, the New Testament is written in Greek. Jesus spoke Hebrew and Aramaic. That's what's so important. Now we get the Hebrew of the time that he spoke. But I haven't spoken about language. If the question comes up, I'll deal with it. Those little fragments that they thought were the Greek origin of Luke, we now know are not from the New Testament. Again, this is a highly sophisticated area. There are Greek translations of the book, which makes the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is the literature between the Bible and the Mishnah. There was a group of literature, a whole library of Jewish books written in addition to the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of these books was called the Book of Enoch. You know another book, by the way, it's the Book of the Maccabees. They were not found there. The Book of Enoch was found. We now know that this is a Greek translation of the Book of Enoch, nothing to do with Luke. And again, I say the earliest book of the New Testament was written after Qumran was destroyed. So no remnant whatsoever of the New Testament. The book that you read from was incorrect. Did you do DNA studies on the cemeteries to see if there are descendants today of the Essenes? We did it not in order to see if they're descendants, but we wanted to know, and we studied first of all, we want to know when the cemeteries were unearthed, all of the bodies were given proper burial, because alongside every archaeological excavator is a gentleman from the chief rabbinate. And therefore, bodies are reinterred with proper burial procedures. But the teeth were extracted and the DNA was applied to the teeth. And from that, we were able to discern the date of the burials, which was very important. And we did this on several of the bodies discovered there, and that is very important because the question always was, is this a celibate monastic group without women? And that's a question by itself. Apparently this group of, let's continue for the sake of this evening's presentation, call them the Essenes. That group was most likely monastic. And then we found women in the cemetery. which scholars jumped upon immediately and say, you see, it was not monastic. Well, we know from other scrolls that were in the Dead Sea Scrolls that there are laws about women. So there possibly could be women, but probably not here. The first women that were found, about five women, and you see how much you have to know in order to be able to do it. They were buried in a direction from east to west. Only Muslims bury east to west. These were Bedouin women who died 200 to 300 years ago. But then we found two other graves of Jewish women, and then they said, well, here's your proof. But that Jewish woman may have been a mother who came to visit her son, may have been a friend, may have been in the area. So the cemetery discoveries are very, very important to us.
I believe Rabbi Talushkin says or writes that the reason that the Essenes died out so quickly is because they were celibate. That's the way I remember it. All right, here's the next question.
Okay, so that you do not remember that as the last sentence, I want to again correct it. No, I mean serious. At Qumran, there is, I would say, 99.9% that they were celibate. But we have in their code of laws pertaining to women of the community, which means the other Essene communities, this was only one of many, had women and they were married. So this was celibate, but the others not. So we cannot generalize. That's the cardinal sin of scholars to generalize. What do you see as long-range implications for living the Jewish faith of life as a result of the discoveries of the scrolls? We see the immense vastness of the roots of our people. We were never a one-track people with one set of literature, with one set of laws. Judaism flourished in what we call a pluriform way. There are many avenues whereby one can attain a full Jewish life.